This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Pierre Prosper, is the first person to win a conviction for genocide in an international tribunal. His case also established the legal definition of what constitutes genocide. Prosper was a prosecutor with the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. The tribunal was established by the UN to try cases relating to the 1994 genocide, in which an estimated 10% of the population was killed. Prosper had previously worked in the Los Angeles DA's office prosecuting gang-related homicides and worked with the U.S. Justice Department prosecuting narcotics cartels and offenders. His genocide case was against Jean-Paul Akayasu, who was mayor of the Rwandan village of Taba, where 2,000 people of the Tutsi minority were killed. Akayasu was convicted last September after a 14-month trial and sentenced to life in prison. A few weeks after winning the conviction, Prosper returned to the U.S. He's now working in the Justice Department. I asked him what Akayasu was convicted of.
One count of genocide, a count of direct and public incitement to commit genocide, three counts of crimes against humanity murder, a count of crimes against humanity extermination, a count of crimes against humanity torture, a count of crimes against humanity other inhumane acts, and a count of crimes against humanity, rape.
Would you describe what you know of his role in the Rwandan genocide?
Well, Mr. Akayesu was the level, was a government official. He was the equivalent of a mayor here in a big city in the United States. His role, the best way to describe it would be as the an administrator of the genocide, in a sense. Because what you had is you had policy people at the top dictating the policy or the doctrine for the genocide, and you had people at the Akayesu level who would actually implement the plan.
So what did he say to help spur on the genocide?
Well, a lot of it was propaganda. What he would do is he would play on the fears of the average farmer. Most of these people were illiterate, essentially telling them that if you did not kill or attack the Tutsis, they would attack you, kill you, or put you into slavery. So he incited the population by telling them that you must go out, you must pick up arms, it is your duty to go out and kill these people.
Now, I've read that he said that you should also rip babies from their mother's wombs.
Exactly. Part of the genocide, it was not limited to the type of victims. They went after young and old alike and fetus. We had several stories that were told in the course of the trial that pregnant women were attacked. They were aborted or basically killed in such inhumane conditions that it was impossible for a fetus to survive. The reason being is that they did not want a Tutsi child born into the world and to come back maybe, you know, 20, 30 years later and be an enemy.
Did Akayesu actually participate in any of the killing?
The evidence that we had and that the chamber agreed with was that he ordered the killings of large numbers of people. We did place him at the scene of several massacre sites, ordering his policemen or militias to go out and kill these people. We did have some evidence that he would actually beat some people before that they were actually killed. But actually, as far as physically killing or committing the act that caused death in the end, there was no evidence as such.
Now, I believe Akayesu never admitted guilt. What was his version of the story?
Well, yeah, Mr. Akayesu, throughout the entire course of the proceedings, never accepted responsibility. Essentially, what his defense was that he was overrun by the militias. He was powerless. He couldn't do anything. He was threatened himself. Like I said, he did not accept or admit any guilt, but what he would say is that he wanted to save the people, but because the militias were so strong, he was unable to do so. Therefore, he sat back passively and watched the genocide unfold in his community.
How convincing was that?
It wasn't convincing at all compared to the evidence that we brought in. We marched in a series of witnesses who placed Akayesu at the scene of massacre sites, giving the orders, watching people being killed, watching the women being raped, encouraging militiamen to rape these women. And also, when you put it in the context of Rwanda, the mayor, or the burgomaster, as it's called in Rwanda, is probably the most powerful person in the day-to-day life of the average citizen. So for him to be powerless was just not credible. Again, because when he would give orders, the community would listen.
What was the most convincing thing you think you said during the trial?
That I said?
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, my goal during the course of the trial was to really present a strong theory of the case. And the theory that I really pushed to the trial chamber was that this was a case of betrayal. It was a case of abuse of power. And I say that again because the position that Akayesu held, he was a person that the average citizen went to for all sorts of advice. If they had a problem with their family members, they went to Akayesu. If they had a land dispute, they went to Akayesu. If they needed an ethnic identity card, they went to Akayesu. So when the people went to him seeking protection and he refused and also turned into a predator, it was a clear case of betrayal. And I felt that once the chamber understood that, they started to understand the case and would accept the evidence that we presented.
This was the first genocide conviction in Rwanda. Did you think you'd get it?
I felt that I would get it. But I have to say it was a difficult case, not for lack of evidence, but it was just difficult for many reasons to work through the logistics of bringing a case of this magnitude to trial. The fact that this has never been done before, there was no precedent. I had to rely on the Genocide Convention of 1948, which is basically a two-page document. Really had to search legal writings from scholars and diplomats alike to see what the global concept of genocide was. Then we had to really break it down and formulate it into a legal, in a sense, policy for the chamber to follow in this case.
This was the first trial that included rape as an instrument of genocide. Why did you decide to include it, and how did you verbally include it as an act of genocide?
There's been a substantial amount of evidence in Rwanda that rape occurred during the events of April, May, and June of 1994. Initially, a problem that we had was linking it up to an accused. We were able to do that in the Akayesu case in the middle of 1997, in June of 1997. We included it as part of genocide because it was clear when you heard the evidence that these women were systematically raped in an effort to not only psychologically destroy them, but to destroy the group, to humiliate them to such an extent that they no longer even act as normal citizens of this earth. They're off to the side, and they're just immaterial and irrelevant in a sense.
Was it hard to get women who had been raped to testify?
It was not easy. The hardest thing to do was to gain their trust. I remember going out in the field and meeting with some of these witnesses. We met on several occasions before they even agreed to come forward. Firstly, because they had to gain my trust, or I had to gain their trust, and their confidence. And after a while, once that began to unfold, they began to talk to me about the events as to what happened. The next issue for them was, okay, would they be ready to talk about this in public, in a court of law, before unknown judges, before the accused, before an international community that was watching? And after spending a lot of time with them and discussing all their concerns and their fears, these women showed amazing strength and came forward and spoke in great detail about exactly what happened to them.
What did it mean culturally for these women to be able to do that?
Well, culturally it was difficult in a sense because generally in Rwanda this is a subject that's taboo. If you've been a victim of rape, you may even be outcast and no longer part of the normal society, which plays right into the genocide theory that we presented to the chamber. But it was amazing that these women showed a collective strength and decided that it was very important that they come forward and have the story be told. It was important that they point the finger of accusation to the accused, letting everyone know what the role of that person was and how that person was responsible for what had happened to them and thousands of other women.
My guest is Pierre Richard Prosper. He was a trial attorney with the Office of the Prosecutor at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. We're going to talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Pierre Richard Prosper. He's the trial attorney with the Office of the Prosecutor at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, who convicted Jean-Paul Akayesu of 9 counts of genocide and crimes against humanity. Akayesu was the mayor of the Rwandan village of Taba, where about a minimum of 2,000 people of the Tutsi minority were killed. What was it like for you to deal with the magnitude of genocide? I mean, you've been used to a lot of terrible crimes and murders and drug cartels, but not genocide.
You know, it's one of those things where it's so unimaginable what happened in Rwanda. The fact that people could commit such heinous offenses, go out and kill in such large numbers. I think what I had to do was to really put a shell around myself and just look at this objectively and try to get the job done. I listened to the stories of the victims, which were horrendous. It was just incredible accounts of what they went through, and took it and objectively applied it to the law that I had and tried to present the best case that I could to the chamber.
Did Akayesu fit your description of a man who was guilty of genocide? Physically, I mean, I don't know if you had an image of your head about what a man who would be capable of genocide would look like.
Well, I'm trying to think back to when I first joined the tribunal, if I had a thought of what a genocidaire or war criminal would look like. It's difficult to say that I had an image in mind, but what I can say is that he did not fit that image. Because when I first saw Akayesu in court, what really stood out to me was that this was an educated man, a charming man in a sense by his presence, persuasive. He was a politician, a family man in a sense. When we saw him in court, he was very respectful of all parties, including myself. It was a complete contrast to the evidence that I had on paper at the time. But as the case evolved, you could see that this was a person with two sides, with two faces. He had the public persona that he would present to the chamber and presumably to the community at some point in time. Then there was this much darker and sinister side that we heard about through the course of the trial and proved to the trial chamber.
Did you come to think of him as a psychopath or a sociopath?
Not really. I mean, the way I saw him was that he was a man that made a cold, calculated political decision to commit genocide. I think what he was doing was looking out for his best interest, political interest, to see what would advance him the furthest. He obviously had to have some level of hatred for the Tutsis to commit these acts, but it really appeared to be a calculated political decision.
It's a very extreme decision. I mean, there's a lot of politicians who we would accuse of backstabbing, maybe, but not genocide.
Oh, exactly. But what you have to do is you have to look at the environment in which he was operating in. It was an environment of genocide, in a sense, at the time. And I say that because the killings began in Rwanda on April the 6th, that evening of 1994. Akayesu did not really join the party, so to speak, until the night of the 18th of April 1994. So in that interim period, the evidence we produced was that he was monitoring the situation to see which way he should go, which way the tide was turning. And he finally made that decision and went with it.
You've tried a lot of cases in the United States. What's something that you were used to doing in U.S. courts that you couldn't do in the War Crimes Tribunal?
One of the things was For example, the rule of evidence and objections. We object quite frequently to certain questions being asked or certain answers. At the tribunal, the judges took the approach of essentially letting a lot of evidence in, and then in the end, they would decide what was relevant and what was credible evidence. I became more comfortable with that in the end because I realized that I was pleading the case to experienced personnel as opposed to a jury who may not have legal training. But that was one of the things that I had to get used to.
You formerly prosecuted gangs in Los Angeles. You worked against the Colombian drug cartel. Do you see any connections between your work prosecuting gangs and gang-related crimes and prosecuting the Colombian drug cartel and your work in Rwanda?
You know, that's... I mean, it is a difficult question in a sense that the magnitude of the offenses is just so different. But what we are dealing with here is human tragedy. We're dealing with people, as far as perpetrators, who are manipulative and manipulated by ideologues or you know, what have you, in a sense. Then you have these victims who are so helpless and so vulnerable to the environment in which they are operating in. And I think you find that, obviously, in the gang communities, you have these helpless victims who may just be standing by and are caught in some sort of gang warfare. With the perpetrators, you have gang members who believe the doctrine that's being administered by their gang members or that community, and they go out and perpetrate these crimes. And in a drug environment, you have people, influential people, taking advantage of a criminal environment for personal gain. And you have the same thing in Rwanda with politicians taking advantage of a genocidal environment for personal gain.
And in all these situations, the people involved with the violence seem to have to find ways to transform their victims into non-people.
Exactly. And that's the thing about genocide, is that the individual, in a sense, just does not matter. You're targeting the group. So that's why I believe that many of these people were able to go out and kill their neighbors. They no longer saw them as their neighbor. They no longer saw them as their friend. They no longer saw them as a family member. They saw them as a Tutsi.
Was there anything that you learned in prosecuting gang members or drug cartel members that you found very helpful in prosecuting Akayesu for genocide?
To prosecute this case, I really had to draw upon a lot of different experiences. And I think one of the main experiences that really helped me here was dealing with victims of violence, acts of violence. The key for me was, I think, to really understand not only the pain, but the fears of the victims, what their concerns are or were. Because the key is to really make the witness or the victim feel comfortable enough to come out and tell the full story. So what I learned from the gang cases, in a sense, was just to sit back and listen to the story. Listen to the victims. Really be a human. Not get caught up in, okay, this is my job. I'm just the prosecutor here. What I would do is I put my prosecutorial hat to the side for a minute and just talk to them as a human being, and then eventually move into the lawyer mode, the prosecutor mode, and prepare them for trial.
How do you think you were changed by this experience of prosecuting for genocide and war crimes?
Well, Terry, I'm still trying to figure that out right now myself. And I think what I'm trying to do is really come to terms with everything that I saw and everything that I heard. What I can say is it's definitely touched me more on the human level. I've become more compassionate to the pain and suffering of people, not only throughout the world, but even here at home. It's easy for us as individuals to read something in the paper and say, oh, gee, that's terrible, and then you turn the page and go to some lighter news. But I think it really takes a special person to pay attention to some of these things and try to do something to make a difference. So I'm hoping that this experience helps me, not only now, but in the future, and I hope I can continue to contribute in some way or form to, I guess, humanity.
Akayesu was convicted and given a life sentence. Was there the possibility of a death sentence? Is there capital punishment in Rwanda?
Well, there is capital punishment in Rwanda, but not in the tribunal. And this was actually a big issue that we had to deal with. The United Nations, in one of his previous, declaration or convention, has a prohibition against the death penalty. So the maximum penalty that we could impose was life imprisonment. But in Rwanda, you actually had the death penalty. And again, the issue was, why should a low-level perpetrator get the death penalty when the high-level orchestrator or organizer receive life imprisonment in some foreign prison. So we were at odds a bit with the Rwandan government, and we just had to explain to them that the international community is against the death penalty.
And the reason for this discrepancy is the people who actually committed the murders were being tried by the Rwanda courts, whereas the people who orchestrated it were being tried by the International Tribunal, which had a different set of standards.
Right, exactly. Exactly. You have this perpetrator in Rwanda being tried by a Rwandan court saying, you know, I'm going to use this as a hypothetical, that, oh, I receive my orders from Akayesu. And then they say, okay, you're guilty, death penalty before a firing squad. Meanwhile, Akayesu is found guilty, and he receives life imprisonment.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Pierre Prosper was a prosecutor with the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. He now works with the Justice Department. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.